Thoughts of God from Fables of Man, Mark Twain. Like Anatole France, choosing a nom de plume less cumbersome than his given one, Samuel Langhorne Clemens became immortal as the author of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. Beloved as an avuncular raconteur and as a humorous public speaker, Twain often had difficulty being taken seriously when he pronounced on graver topics. But those who have read his polemics against war and imperialism and against the cruelties of religion are aware that his wit could be mordant. As we keep finding in this story, the climate of bigotry often meant that these essays could not be published in Twain's lifetime. How often we are moved to admit the intelligence exhibited in both the designing and the execution of some of his works. Take The Fly, for instance. The planning of The Fly was an application of pure intelligence, morals not being concerned. Not one of us could have planned The Fly. Not one of us could have constructed him. And no one would have considered it wise to try, except under an assumed name. It is believed by some that The Fly was introduced to meet a long-felt want. In the course of ages, for some reason or other, there have been millions of these persons. But out of this vast multitude, there has not been one who has been willing to explain what the want was, at least satisfactorily. A few have explained that there was a need for a creature to remove disease-breeding garbage, but these being then asked to explain what long-felt want the disease-breeding garbage was introduced to supply, they have not been willing to undertake the contract. There is much inconsistency concerning The Fly. In all the ages he has not had a friend. There has never been a person in the earth who could have been persuaded to intervene between him and extermination. Yet billions of persons have excused the hand that made him, and this without a blush. Would they have excused a man in the same circumstances, a man positively known to have invented The Fly? On the contrary. For the credit of the race, let us believe it would have been all day with that man. Would persons consider it just to reprobate in a child, with its undeveloped morals, a scandal that they would overlook in the Pope? When we reflect that The Fly was not invented for pastime, but in the way of business, that he was not flung off in a heedless moment and with no object in view but to pass the time, but was the fruit of long and painstaking labor and calculation, and with a definite and far-reaching purpose in view, that his character and conduct were planned out with cold deliberation, that his career was foreseen and foreordained, and that there was no want which he could supply. We are hopelessly puzzled. We cannot understand the moral lapse that was able to render possible the conceiving and the consummation of this squalid and malevolent creature. Let us try to think the unthinkable. Let us try to imagine a man of a sort willing to invent The Fly. That is to say, a man destitute of feeling, a man willing to wantonly torture and harass and persecute myriads of creatures who had never done him any harm, and could not if they wanted to, and the majority of them, poor dumb things, not even aware of his existence. In a word, let us try to imagine a man with so singular and so lumbering a code of morals as this, that it is fair and right to send afflictions upon the just, upon the unoffending as well as upon the offending, without discrimination. If we can imagine such a man, that is the man that could invent The Fly, and send him out on his mission and furnish him his orders, depart into the uttermost corners of the earth, and diligently do your appointed work. Persecute the sick child, settle upon its eyes, its face, its hands, and gnaw and pester and sting. Worry and fret and madden the worn and tired mother who watches by the child, and who humbly prays for mercy and relief with the pathetic faith of the deceived and the unteachable. Settle upon the soldier's festering wounds in field and hospital and drive him frantic while he also prays, and between times curses, with none to listen but you, Fly, who get all the petting and all the protection without even praying for it. Harry and persecute the forlorn and forsaken wretch who is perishing of the plague, and in his terror and despair praying, bite, sting, feed upon his ulcers, Dabble your feet in his rotten blood. Gum them thick with plague germs. Feet cunningly designed and perfected for this function ages ago in the beginning. Carry this freight to 100 tables, among the just and the unjust, the high and the low, and walk over the food and guam it with filth and death. Visit all. Allow no man peace till he get in the grave. Visit and afflict the hard-worked and unoffending horse, mule, ox, ass, pester the patient cow, and all the kindly animals that labour without fair reward here and perish without hope of it hereafter. Spare no creature, wild or tame, but wheresoever you find one, make his life a misery. Treat him as the innocent deserve, and so please me, and increase my glory, who made the fly. We hear much about his patience and forbearance and long-suffering. We hear nothing about our own, which much exceeds it. We hear much about his mercy and kindness and goodness, in words, the words of his book and of his pulpit. And the meek multitude is content with this evidence, such as it is, seeking no further. But whoso searcheth after a concrete example of it will in time acquire fatigue, there being no instances of it. For what are gilded as mercies are not, in any recorded case, more than mere common justices, and due without thanks or compliment. To rescue without personal risk a cripple from a burning house is not a mercy, it is a mere commonplace duty. Anybody would do it that could, and not by proxy either, delegating the work but confiscating the credit for it. If men neglected God's poor, and God's stricken and helpless ones, as he does, what would become of them? The answer is to be found in those dark lands where man follows his example and turns his indifferent back upon them. They get no help at all. They cry and plead and pray in vain. They linger and suffer and miserably die. If you will look at the matter rationally and without prejudice, the proper place to hunt for the facts of his mercy is not where man does the mercies and he collects the praise, but in those regions where he has the field to himself. It is plain that there is one moral law for heaven and another for the earth. The pulpit assures us that wherever we see suffering and sorrow, which we can relieve and do not do it, we sin heavily. There was never yet a case of suffering or sorrow which God could not relieve. Does he sin then? If he is the source of morals, he does. Certainly nothing can be plainer than that, you will admit. Surely the source of law cannot violate law and stand unsmirched. Surely the judge upon the bench cannot forbid crime and then revel in it himself, unreproached. Nevertheless, we have this curious spectacle. Daily, the trained parrot in the pulpit gravely delivers himself of these ironies, which he has acquired at second hand, and adopted without examination to a trained congregation which accepts them without examination, and neither the speaker nor the hearer laughs at himself. It does seem as if we ought to be humble when we are at a bench show, and not put on airs of intellectual superiority there. Bible teaching and religious practice, from Europe and elsewhere, and a pen warmed up in hell. Mark Twain. Religion had its share in the changes of civilization and national character, of course. What share? The lions? In the history of the human race, this has always been the case, will always be the case, to the end of time, no doubt, or at least until man, by the slow process of evolution, shall develop into something really fine and high. Some billions of years hence, say. The Christian Bible is a drugstore. Its contents remain the same, but the medical practice changes. For 1800 years, these changes were slight, scarcely noticeable. The practice was allopathic. Allopathic in its rudest and crudest form. The dull and ignorant physician, day and night, and all the days and all the nights, drenched his patient with vast and hideous doses of the most repulsive drugs to be found in the store's stock. He bled him, cupped him, purged him, puked him, salivated him, never gave his system a chance to rally, nor nature a chance to help. He kept him religion sick for 18 centuries, and allowed him not a well day during all that time. The stock in the store was made up of about equal portions of baleful and debilitating poisons, and healing and comforting medicines, but the practice of the time confined the physician to the use of the former. By consequence, he could only damage his patient, and that is what he did. Not until far within our century was any considerable change in the practice introduced, and then mainly, or in effect only, in Great Britain and the United States. In the other countries today, the patient either still takes the ancient treatment or does not call the physician at all. In the English-speaking countries, the changes observable in our century were forced by that very thing just referred to, the revolt of the patient against the system. They were not projected by the physician. The patient fell to doctoring himself, and the physician's practice began to fall off. He modified his methods to get back his trade. He did it gradually, reluctantly, and never yielded more at a time than the pressure compelled. At first he relinquished the daily dose of hell and damnation, and administered it every other day only. Next he allowed another day to pass, then another, and presently another. When he had restricted it at last to Sundays, and imagined that now there would surely be a truce, the homeopath arrived on the field and made him abandon hell and damnation altogether, and administered Christ's love and comfort and charity and compassion in its stead. These had been in the drugstore all the time, gold-labeled and conspicuous among the long shelf-loads of repulsive purges and vomits and poisons, and so the practice was to blame that they had remained unused, not the pharmacy. To the ecclesiastical physician of 50 years ago, his predecessor for 18 centuries was a quack. To the ecclesiastical physician of today, his predecessor of 50 years ago was a quack. To the every man his own ecclesiastical doctor of when, what will the ecclesiastical physician of today be? Unless evolution, which has been a truth ever since the globes, suns, and planets of the solar system were but wandering films of meteor dust, shall reach a limit and become a lie, there is but one fate in store for him. The methods of the priest and the parson have been very curious. Their history is very entertaining. In all the ages, the Roman Church has owned slaves, bought and sold slaves, authorized and encouraged her children to trade in them. Long after some Christian peoples had freed their slaves, the Church still held on to hers. If any could know, to absolute certainty, that all this was right and according to God's will and desire, surely it was she, since she was God's specially appointed representative in the earth and sole authorized and infallible expounder of his Bible. There were the texts. There was no mistaking their meaning. She was right. She was doing in this thing what the Bible had mapped out for her to do. So unassailable was her position that in all the centuries she had no word to say against human slavery. Yet now, at last, in our immediate day, we hear a pope saying slave trading is wrong, and we see him sending an expedition to Africa to stop it. The texts remain. It is the practice that has ever changed. Why? Because the world has corrected the Bible. The Church never corrects it, and also never fails to drop in at the tail of the procession, and take the credit of the correction, as she will presently do in this instance. Christian England supported slavery and encouraged it for 250 years, and her Church's consecrated ministers looked on, sometimes taking an active hand, the rest of the time indifferent. England's interest in the business may be called a Christian interest, a Christian industry. She had her full share in its revival after a long period of inactivity, and his revival was a Christian monopoly, that is to say, it was in the hands of Christian countries exclusively. English parliaments aided the slave traffic and protected it. Two English kings held stock in slave-catching companies. The first regular English slave hunter, John Hawkins, of still revered memory, made such successful havoc on his second voyage in the matter of surprising and burning villages, and maiming, slaughtering, capturing, and selling their unoffending inhabitants, that his delighted queen conferred the chivalric honour of knighthood on him, a rank which had acquired its chief esteem and distinction in other and earlier fields of Christian effort. The new knight, with characteristic English frankness and brusque simplicity, chose as his device the figure of a negro slave, kneeling and in chains. Sir John's work was the invention of Christians, was to remain a bloody and awful monopoly in the hands of Christians for a quarter of a millennium, was to destroy homes, separate families, enslave friendless men and women, and break a myriad of human hearts to the end that Christian nations might be prosperous and comfortable, Christian churches be built, and the gospel of the meek and merciful Redeemer be spread abroad in the earth. And so in the name of his ship, unsuspected but eloquent and clear, lay hidden prophecy. She was called the Jesus. But at last in England, an illegitimate Christian rose against slavery. It is curious that when a Christian rises against a rooted wrong at all, he is usually an illegitimate Christian, member of some despised and bastard sect. There was a bitter struggle, but in the end the slave trade had to go, and went. The biblical authorization remained, but the practice changed. Then the usual thing happened. The visiting English critic among us began straightway to hold up his pious hands in horror at our slavery. His distress was unappeasable, his words full of bitterness and contempt. It is true we had not so many as 1,500,000 slaves for him to worry about, while his England still owned 12,000,000 in her foreign possessions, but that fact did not modify his wail any, or stay his tears, or soften his censure. The fact that every time we had tried to get rid of our slavery in previous generations, but had always been obstructed, balked, and defeated by England, was a matter of no consequence to him. It was ancient history, and not worth the telling. Our own conversion came at last. We began to stir against slavery. Hearts grew soft, here, there, and yonder. There was no place in the land where the seeker could not find some small budding sign of pity for the slave. No place in all the land but one, the pulpit. It yielded at last, it always does. It fought a strong and stubborn fight, and then did what it always does, joined the procession at the tail end. Slavery fell. The slavery text remained. The practice changed. That was all. During many ages there were witches. The Bible said so. The Bible commanded that they should not be allowed to live. Therefore the church, after doing its duty in but a lazy and indolent way for 800 years, gathered up its halters, thumbscrews, and firebrands, and set about its holy work in earnest. She worked hard at it, night and day, during 9 centuries, and imprisoned, tortured, hanged, and burned whole hordes and armies of witches, and washed the Christian world clean with their foul blood. Then it was discovered that there were no such thing as witches, and never had been. One does not know whether to laugh or to cry. Who discovered that there was no such thing as a witch? The priest? The parson? No. These never discover anything. At Salem, the parson clung pathetically to his witch text, after the laity had abandoned it, in remorse and tears for the crimes and cruelties it had persuaded them to do. The parson wanted more blood, more shame, more brutalities. It was the unconsecrated laity that stayed his hand. In Scotland, the parson killed the witch after the magistrate had pronounced her innocent. And when the merciful legislature proposed to sweep the hideous laws against witches from the statute book, it was the parson who came imploring, with tears and imprecations, that they be suffered to stand. There are no witches. The witch text remains. Only the practice has changed. Hellfire is gone, but the text remains. Infant damnation is gone, but the text remains. More than 200 death penalties are gone from the law books, but the texts that authorize them remain. It is not well worthy of note that of all the multitude of texts through which man has driven his annihilating pen, he has never once made the mistake of obliterating a good and useful one. It does certainly seem to suggest that if man continues in the direction of enlightenment, his religious practice may, in the end, attain some semblance of human decency. The Christian revelation makes statements which, if true, are undoubtedly of the very highest importance. God is angry with man. Unless we believe and repent, we shall all be damned. It is impossible, indeed, for its advocates even to say this without instantly contradicting themselves. Their doctrine frightens them. They explain, in various ways, that a great many people will be saved without believing, and that eternal damnation is not eternal nor damnation. It is only the vulgar who hold such views, and who, of course, must not be disturbed in them. But they are not for the intelligent. God grants uncovenanted mercies. That is, he sometimes lets a sinner off, though he has not made a legal bargain about it, an explanation calculated to exalt our conceptions of the deity. But let us pass over these endless shufflings from the horrible to the meaningless. Christianity tells us in various ways how the wrath of the Creator may be appeased and his good will ensured. The doctrine is manifestly important to believers, but does it give us a clearer or happier view of the universe? That is what is required for the confusion of agnostics, and if the mystery were in part solved, or the clouds thinned in the slightest degree, Christianity would triumph by its inherent merits. Let us then ask once more, does Christianity exhibit the ruler of the universe as benevolent or as just? If I were to assert that of every 10 beings born into this world, 9 would be damned, that all who refused to believe what they did not hold to be proved, and all who sinned from overwhelming temptation, and all who had not had the good fortune to be subjects of a miraculous conversion, or the recipients of a grace conveyed by a magical charm, would be tortured to all eternity, what would an orthodox theologian reply? He could not say, "That is false." I might appeal to the highest authorities for my justification. Nor, in fact, could he, on his own showing, deny the possibility. Hell, he says, exists. He does not know who will be damned, though he does know that all men are by nature corrupt and liable to be damned, if not saved by supernatural grace. He might, and probably would, now say, "That is rash. You have no authority for saying how many will be lost and how many saved. You cannot even say what is meant by hell or heaven. You cannot tell how far God may be better than his word, though you may be sure that he won't be worse than his word." And what is all this but to say, we know nothing about it? In other words, to fall back on agnosticism. The difficulty, as theologians truly say, is not so much that evil is eternal, as that evil exists. That is in substance a frank admission that, as nobody can explain evil, nobody can explain anything. Your revelation, which was to prove the benevolence of God, has proved only that God's benevolence may be consistent with the eternal and infinite misery of most of his creatures. You escape only by saying that it is also consistent with their not being eternally and infinitely miserable. That is, the revelation reveals nothing. Author's note to The Shadow Line, Joseph Conrad. A dislike or distrust of superstition and the supernatural need not mean there is a deafness to the marvelous and the mysterious. Here Joseph Conrad makes the distinction finely in his preface to one of his most powerful novels. This story, which I admit to be, in its brevity, a fairly complex piece of work, was not intended to touch on the supernatural. Yet more than one critic has been inclined to take it in that way, seeing in it an attempt on my part to give the fullest scope to my imagination by taking it beyond the confines of the world of living, suffering humanity. But, as a matter of fact, my imagination is not made of stuff so elastic as all that. I believe that if I attempted to put the strain of the supernatural on it, it would fail deplorably and exhibit an unlovely gap. But I could never have attempted such a thing, because all my moral and intellectual being is penetrated by an invincible conviction that whatever falls under the dominion of our senses must be in nature and, however exceptional, cannot differ in its essence from all the other effects of the visible and tangible world of which we are a self-conscious part. The world of the living contains enough marvels and mysteries as it is. Marvels and mysteries acting upon our emotions and intelligence in ways so inexplicable that it would almost justify the conception of life as an enchanted state. No, I am too firm in my consciousness of the marvellous to be ever fascinated by the mere supernatural, which, take it any way you like, is but a manufactured article, the fabrication of minds insensitive to the intimate delicacies of our relation to the dead and to the living, in their countless multitudes, a desecration of our tenderest memories, an outrage on our dignity. Whatever my native modesty may be, it will never condescend so low as to seek help for my imagination within those vain imaginings common to all ages, and that in themselves are enough to fill all lovers of mankind with unutterable sadness. As to the effect of a mental or moral shock on a common mind, it is quite a legitimate subject for study and description. Mr. Burns's moral being receives a severe shock in his relations with his late captain, and this, in his diseased state, turns into a mere superstitious fancy compounded of fear and animosity. This fact is one of the elements of the story, but there is nothing supernatural in it, nothing, so to speak, from beyond the confines of this world, which, in all conscience, holds enough mystery and terror in itself. Perhaps if I had published this tale, which I have had for a long time in my mind, under the title of First Command, no suggestion of the supernatural would have been found in it by any impartial reader, critical or otherwise. I will not consider here the origins of the feeling in which its actual title, The Shadow Line, occurred to my mind. Primarily, the aim of this piece of writing was the presentation of certain facts, which certainly were associated with the change from youth, carefree and fervent, to the more self-conscious and more poignant period of maturer life. Nobody can doubt that before the supreme trial of a whole generation, I had an acute consciousness of the minute and insignificant character of my own obscure experience. There could be no question here of any parallelism. That notion never entered my head. But there was a feeling of identity, though with an enormous difference of scale, as of one single drop measured against the bitter and stormy immensity of an ocean. And this was very natural, too, for when we begin to meditate on the meaning of our own past, it seems to fill all the world in its profundity and its magnitude. This book was written in the last 3 months of the year 1916. Of all the subjects of which a writer of tales is more or less conscious within himself, this is the only one I found it possible to attempt at the time. The depth and the nature of the mood with which I approached it is best expressed, perhaps, in the dedication which strikes me now as a most disproportionate thing, as but another instance of the overwhelming greatness of our own emotion to ourselves. This much having been said, I may pass on now to a few remarks about the mere material of the story. As to locality, it belongs to that part of the Eastern Seas from which I have carried away into my writing life the greatest number of suggestions. From my statement that I thought of this story for a long time under the title of First Command, the reader may guess that it is concerned with my personal experience. And, as a matter of fact, it is personal experience seen in perspective with the eye of the mind and coloured by that affection one can't help feeling for such events of one's life, as one has no reason to be ashamed of. And that affection is as intense, I appeal here to universal experience, as the shame, and almost the anguish with which one remembers some unfortunate occurrences, down to mere mistakes in speech, that have been perpetrated by one in the past. The effect of perspective in memory is to make things loom large because the essentials stand out isolated from their surroundings of insignificant daily facts which have naturally faded out of one's mind. I remember that period of my sea life with pleasure because, begun inauspiciously, it turned out in the end a success from a personal point of view, leaving a tangible proof in the terms of the letter the owners of the ship wrote to me 2 years afterwards, when I resigned my command in order to come home. This resignation marked the beginning of another phase of my seaman's life, its terminal phase, if I may say so, which in its own way has coloured another portion of my writings. I didn't know then how near its end my sea life was, and therefore I felt no sorrow except at parting with the ship. I was sorry also to break my connection with the firm who owned her, and who were pleased to receive with friendly kindness and give their confidence to a man who had entered their service in an accidental manner and in very adverse circumstances. Without disparaging the earnestness of my purpose, I suspect now that luck had no small part in the success of the trust reposed in me, and one cannot help remembering with pleasure the time when one's best efforts were seconded by a run of luck. The words, "worthy of my undying regard," selected by me for the motto on the title page, are quoted from the text of the book itself, and, though one of my critics surmised that they applied to the ship, it is evident from the place where they stand that they refer to the men of that ship's company, complete strangers to their new captain, and who yet stood by him so well during those 20 days that seemed to have been passed on the brink of a slow and agonizing destruction. And that is the greatest memory of all. For surely it is a great thing to have commanded a handful of men worthy of one's undying regard.